The most beautiful man never performs hard labor. I am sure my grandfather would be ashamed of my hands, for they carry nothing and are soft as downy feathers. And I am sure he'd look askance at my treasured collection of stemless wine glasses and fashionable ascots.
That's poet Major Jackson reading from his poem, The Most Beautiful Man Never Performs Hard Labor. He has a new collection of poetry out spanning two decades of his work, and we will talk to him about that later in the show. First, though, more than 100 people were killed in a pair of explosions in Iran. Nearly 200 people were wounded. The bombings happened at a commemoration of Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian military leader who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq 4 years ago. Those attacks came just a day after Saleh al-Aruri, a prominent Hamas leader, was killed in an explosion in a Beirut suburb. Israel has not taken responsibility for that killing, though anonymous U.S. officials have attributed the killing to Israel. And no one has taken responsibility for those bombings in Iran, and the United States denies being involved. We're going to talk about this now with Hanin Gadar, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's first talk about the bombings in Iran. We don't know who is responsible. The U.S. denies saying it was involved, says it was not involved. And what, if any, link is there to Israel or to this war in Gaza? What do you see so far?
On this issue, most likely it is not an Israel. Israel is not behind it. The U.S. is not behind it. Europeans, the Western world is not even behind it. So far, most of the analysis so far that this has the MO of an internal ISIS-related group that has done the similar things before, that have attacked mosques and religious sites before. Most likely it's them, but it will be too early to know. We might not know anytime soon. What's interesting really is that the Iranian regime has not accused the Israelis or the Americans yet. One, because they don't really think that Israel or America is behind it. And two, even if they want to use this opportunity to accuse Israel, they will have to do something about it. And they don't want to do anything about it at this moment, because they don't want to trigger anything that would lead to some kind of a conflict with Israel or the U.S.
Okay. All right. So that gets us to the assassination of this Hamas official. He was number two, as I understand it, in the organization.
Yes.
Saleh al-Aruri. Tell us more about him, who he was, and what he was doing in Lebanon.
So Saleh al-Aruri is number two in Hamas, as you said. He also is the military guy, the guy who actually founded the military wing of Hamas. And he was the leader, the military leader of Hamas. In that sense, he also was the main guy, the main link between Hamas and the Iranian regime. That's why he was in Dahi, because he was the closest Hamas guy to Hezbollah. Any leadership within Hamas, and we all know that Hamas is divided in that sense, but the faction of Hamas that is closer to the Iranian regime, the IRGC, to Hezbollah, is Saleh al-Aruri. And that is why he was in Lebanon. He was in Gaza and then was kicked out, and he went to Turkey, Qatar, and eventually was kicked out of all these places because of his links to Iran. But then eventually he founded a safe ground in safe haven in Beirut's Hezbollah stronghold, which is the southern suburbs of Beirut, where he has been residing for a long time. Because of these links and because of his background and his current residency until he was assassinated, he was the guy who was building the Hamas military wing in Lebanon. So he has been attending all the meetings with Hezbollah's leadership, Hassan Nasrallah and others, with the Iranian regime leadership in Beirut to form what has been referred to in the past few months as the United Front. of resistance. He was a key person in this united front. He was the key person in working with Hezbollah to take over the Palestinian decision within the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. He was the guy, and he was Hamas's guy in Lebanon. He was Hamas leader, the military leader, and he was Hamas link to the Iranian regime.
So this sounds like he was a significant player, and this is a significant loss for Hamas.
Yes, absolutely. I would even say that for Hamas, he is what is equivalent to what was Imad Mughniyeh was for Hezbollah. Imad Mughniyeh was their main military commander, the guy who actually transformed Hezbollah's military from a small group of militants to an actual army. And he was assassinated in Damascus in 2008 in a joint operation between the CIA and the Mossad. Aruri, I think, although he's not as big as Mughniyeh, but for Hamas, he is that significant. The loss of Aruri is obviously equivalent to Hezbollah's loss of Mughniyeh, the guy who can claim victories.
Right. And what was his role in the October 7th attacks in Israel in terms of planning and carrying them out?
Well, obviously, he was very much involved. He was part of the planning. He is Hamas military leader. So anything that Hamas would be conducting on the ground militarily, including October 7, I wouldn't be surprised if he was the main guy behind it. He and others, of course, not he himself, but as someone who was coordinating with Iran on the know-how, the logistics, the arm transfers, all of that, if he's the guy responsible for all these logistics, then he's definitely one of the main guys responsible for October 7.
And you say he was kicked out of Gaza. Did he not have a good relationship with the leader of Hamas there, Yahya Sinwar?
It's been said many times that he and Sinwar were not really on good terms, mostly because apparently, according to the Gaza Palestinian experts that we've been talking to, I'm more of a Hezbollah expert, but that he basically was closer to the people. He was liked by the people more. He has some kind of charisma, like Hassan Nasrallah. He has he was more charming than Sinwar. Sinwar is more frightening and more of that. Someone who that the Gazans didn't really see as their leader. So this led to a lot of disagreements. And of course, the link with Iran was he was the Iran's favorite. He was the spoiled child, if you want, within Hamas of the Iranian regime. That also led to some differences, which eventually but I don't think Sinwar himself kicked him out of Gaza. I think at one point he started to be a part of the network that was starting and building Hamas in the West Bank. And this is where he was eventually moved to Turkey, to Qatar, and then finally Lebanon. He became more integrated in the Iranian system.
Okay. So he wanted to build up Hamas's presence in the West Bank.
Yes, he was part of it. He was a big part of it.
So what now in terms of Lebanon's response or Hezbollah's response? Because Nasrallah, who runs Hezbollah, had said before the October 7th attacks, he said back in August that any assassination in Lebanon would be met with a, quote, decisive response. So will there be a decisive response from Hezbollah?
Well, not anytime soon, obviously. We watched Hassan Nasrallah's speech today, and I personally wasn't expecting a substantial response, knowing how Hezbollah's facing many challenges within its military apparatus today. Also, like, Iran is not interested in war today, but I was expecting at least some kind of response, like a barrage of long-range missiles, something that would save face. But even that he didn't do, because I think, which is really harming Hezbollah's resistance rhetoric and image within the Arab world, which is, you see, the Arab world today is looking at what's happening in Gaza as the Palestinians being abandoned by the Arabs, etc. But usually Hezbollah is the one who actually does something about it. And today Hezbollah's saying, Hassan Nasrallah in his first speech contradicted everything he said before. In his first speech after after October 7, which was a month later, which was very telling that it took him a month to respond, basically threw Hamas under the bus and said that this is a Hamas, this is a Palestinian issue, and the Palestinians have the right to fight, to lead this battle. So we will just support them. But basically what he's saying, that we're no longer part of the resistance, on the ground resistance, because Hassan Nasrallah knows that their job since 2006, which was their last war with Israel, has changed drastically, and their challenges have increased. Their job today is not to liberate Palestine, as what their rhetoric usually is about. Their job is not to fight Israel. Their job is to protect Iran's interests in the region. And they will start a war with Israel when Iran sees fit. And Iran will see this, the right moment for this, when Iran is personally attacked, not when the Palestinians are attacked, not when Gaza is being bombed. It's when Iran itself is under attack, then it will use Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah hasn't really started a war with Israel the way we think they could, because they haven't used the two main assets they have, which is the precision-guided missiles and the Radwan elite forces at the border. However, that being said, Israel is not going to live with these two assets at its borders after the brutal attack of October 7, because the Radwan can infiltrate Israel if they want to and do exactly what Hamas did. Mm-hmm. So this will lead to some kind of confrontation.
Okay, we have just a few seconds left, but I'm wondering what this means for the hostages in Gaza and whether or not that complicates the efforts to free them.
Well, it might complicate the efforts to free them at this point. There's something that there will be some reaction. We're seeing reactions from the Hamas leadership, from the streets. However, the initial reaction does not really represent the reality of what's going on, which is Hamas today in Gaza, inside Gaza, is in a much weaker position. They have been abandoned by the Iranian, by Hezbollah, by the United Front. They are on their own, and they're fighting a lost battle in a way, because it's like, although the public opinion is with them, the Arab public opinion is kind of, you know, like supporting the resistance part of what's happening, the military battle is lost. So they will definitely use the hostages to protect themselves. And this is a question of how what kind of a deal that Israel is ready to do with Hamas in order to help the hostages. But they, I think, at one point, eventually, maybe not tomorrow or the next day, but eventually, Hamas will try as much as it can to use the hostages. And this is going to become number one fight for Hamas.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your analysis. That's Hanin Gadar, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Coming up, how Harvard's president was undone by the culture wars and by herself, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Claudine Gay, Harvard's first Black president, resigned yesterday after just 6 months on the job. Her short tenure began to unravel last month after a congressional hearing on campus hate speech. She was criticized for her lawyerly responses to questions about anti-Semitism amid the Israel-Hamas war.
Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment, yes or no?
It can be, depending on the context.
Gay's scholarly work also came under scrutiny from conservative activists. She faced mounting accusations of plagiarism. Her resignation follows that of the president of the University of Pennsylvania, who stepped down a few days after the congressional hearing. It all highlights the turmoil on American campuses, amplified by the war in Gaza, and the conservative backlash to elite education, to DEI, affirmative action. Joining me now is Nicholas Confessori, political and investigative reporter for The New York Times. Hello.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
Okay, great. What a stew.
Yes.
I don't know anyone who would want to be the next president of Harvard, but anyway, it'll be somebody and not Claudine Gay. So what really undid her? Was it that appearance before Elise Stefanik and her response to that question, or was it the accusations of plagiarism, a little bit of both?
You know, what's so kind of maddening for me as a reporter is you don't actually know exactly what undid her. The statement from Harvard, you know, presumably from the board announcing her departure, makes no mention of any wrongdoing or a belief in her wrongdoing. Her own statement as to why she was left makes no reference to any wrongdoing. It sort of posits it that she'd become too much of a distraction. So we don't really know yet what was going on behind the scenes. I think you can safely say, though, that the proximate cause of her departure was her own plagiarism, her own work, and her testimony at that hearing in December.
Mm. Right. But she doesn't really address the plagiarism accusations. Like, she doesn't defend herself in her resignation letter. So what has she said about that? And there have been 47 complaints of plagiarism.
That's right. I mean, to my knowledge, both she and Harvard have kind of dismissed these complaints or downplay them as not that important. I think reasonable people are looking at some of these examples and saying that's not going to fly. Some of them seem evident, but you can get different opinions on the seriousness of different of these allegations. I think what really matters, if we just pull back for a second, if you're the president of Harvard University, being accused of plagiarism in multiple many instances, is a really bad thing, regardless of what else is happening around the country or in politics.
Mm-hmm. But also people are saying, where did this come from? And why did it come up now? And does that cast a pall over the accusations? In other words, was it something ginned up by conservatives who wanted to get rid of her to begin with? And not the plagiarism itself, but these accusations and bringing them forth at this particular time. And does that then kind of shade it in a way?
Well, look, I don't think you can say these events have been ginned up by conservatives, because her actions produced the conditions that allowed her critics to put pressure on her. But I do mm-hmm. think you can look at the bigger picture here a little bit and see two things happening at the same time. The first is this moment of real weakness for Harvard and other elite institutions, but Harvard kind of under the microscope for its handling of pro-Palestine protests on campus, for complaints from Jewish students and alumni and others that they didn't feel safe on the campus. Her own testimony at that hearing, which many people felt was just too lawyerly to really fit the moment. So you have that one set of things happening. And at the same time, you have this burgeoning movement on the right to remake higher education, to get rid of DEI programs, to get rid of what they would call wokeism and elitism and leftism on campus. And they cast her, I think not entirely unfairly, as an avatar of some of those trends in higher education. She had been, as a dean and as a president of Harvard, one architect of Harvard's own response to George Floyd, to complaints about representation on campus, to complaints about statues of John Harvard and other old figures at Harvard's campus. So I think she had become a stand-in for a lot of trends in higher education that conservatives and reformers on the right were already really mobilized about.
Okay, so she becomes that, and also the fact that she is the head of America's most prestigious university, too. So if this had happened at, I don't know, a community college in Oregon, no one probably would be batting an eyelash.
Well,
or not
know,
many
probably
eyelashes.
Not be as long a story. You're right that all of these things are true at the same time. It's a big target. And mm-hmm. to catch the president of at least the most storied institution in America, if not the most prestigious or the best, the most storied, is a big deal. Because, you know, Harvard holds itself out as being among the best or the best universities in the country. And so for them to get this wrong and for its president to have these kinds of blemishes on her academic record is a serious thing.
Okay, so the Penn president also stepped down, and MIT, the president there, she still has her job, but for how much longer, do you think?
You know, I don't have any reporting on how things are going at MIT. You know, I assume that somebody out there is taking a look at her academic work or his academic work. Look, I do think that there are some on the right, and one of them is Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from New York, who has made clear her desire is to see all three of them go. All three of the presidents who testified at that hearing in December, she wants all of them to go. Many others around the country have said, yeah, that performance at that hearing was so bad, they should all go. I don't know what happens at MIT. I'm not sure that the same energy is there for getting rid of that university president, but time will tell.
Right. Okay, so in the bigger picture, how do universities respond to this when it comes to activism on campus, do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting to go back and think about that hearing and the answers they gave, which I think a lot of people at that moment with this war raging in the Middle East saw those answers as bloodless. Yeah. But when you talk to people who are involved in these issues of campus free speech, their main gripe with what the president said in that hearing was that they didn't apply that principle equally in the past. In other words, the presidents had given a legal argument in favor of maximum free speech on campus, that unless somebody's rhetoric is actually becoming physical harassment of a person, you allow it in the interest of free speech. The complaint that you'll get from experts who study free speech on these campuses is that there are so many examples on each of these campuses where that principle was not upheld. And so one option for these schools is to actually stick with that idea and say that we're going to allow people to say things, even terrible things, on campus, as long as they aren't actually physically threatening an individual person. Or they can say, we're going to expand the regime of kind of protection and safety on campus and avoiding people feeling bad about what's said on campus, and expand that even further and maybe include Jews in it. Right. Mm-hmm. That's one way to do it. And I don't know which way it's going to go, because there's a third option. And you see this mostly in red states, where Republicans can use their control of legislatures and other offices to essentially demand changes through their budget power over state universities. And what you see on those schools is we're going to abolish DEI offices completely. We're going to ban discussion of critical race theory from some classes. We're going to stop schools from requiring that students or job applicants sign on to certain ideas about race and justice in order to apply for jobs. There's a variety of ways it can go, and I suspect we're going to see very different approaches in blue states and red states, and in public universities and private ones.
The divide persists in the American culture. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
That's Nicholas Confessori, political and investigative reporter for The New York Times. Coming up, the poet Major Jackson is here. His latest collection focuses on climate change.
We are quite possibly going to lose shorelines. I'm thinking of Florida, California, and then if I go to those forests, they're burned.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Poet Major Jackson has learned to blend two worlds, that of growing up poor in North Philadelphia and becoming a celebrated poet, winning prestigious awards and appreciating, as he says, the poets Lorca and Wordsworth. Jackson celebrates two decades of poetry with his new book, Razzle Dazzle, New and Selected Poems from 2002 to 2022. Here he is reading one of those poems. It's called "The Most Beautiful Man Never Performs Hard Labor."
The most beautiful man never performs hard labor. I am sure my grandfather would be ashamed of my hands, for they carry nothing and are soft as downy feathers. And I am sure he'd look askance at my treasured collection of stemless wine glasses and fashionable ascots. I'm sure he'd smirk at the sight of fresh-cut flowers delivered at my door Tuesday afternoons when my silken thoughts make like schools of minnows. And so, too, the cantatas filling my house and me paddling like a dog through the recitatives, so unaccustomed my hands to the shape and feel of a revolver or the wood shaving tools he kept in his tool belt like armaments. I am sure he'd shake his head at my having paused beneath a fruit tree on a bicycle with a basket carrying a French baguette and a collection of Lorca's poetry angling for a woman's touch.
That's Major Jackson reading his poem, "The Most Beautiful Man Never Performs Hard Labor." Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with you.
It's great to have you. All right. You're painting a picture of two different lives. And it's those are two very different lives. And you say that your grandfather would be ashamed. Was he ashamed of you?
No. You know, it's a great exaggeration and probably bespeaks my own anxieties of not having taken up a life like a good deal of my family members who were construction workers. I made a life of reading books and writing books and teaching and living a life of the mind. And my grandfather was a bricklayer. I mean, I come from working class people and I've lived a life of relative comfort. And in fact, when I won my first literary prize, I won't say the amount here, but when he found out, he said, "Are they giving you that amount of money to write poems?" I said, "Yeah." And then he said, "Turn around. I want to see where that horse kicked you in your butt." I.e., you're so lucky. But it was foreign to him. You know, it was utterly foreign. So I guess it's not so much anxieties as much as I want to kind of call attention to some of the lives of people who kind of work 9 to 5, work with their bodies. He lived a long time, and I attribute that to him using his body, you know, as his tool to earn a living.
You have another poem called Euphoria.
Yes.
And Whoa. Is that autobiographical?
Not all of it, no. Did I have a parent that suffered from addiction? Yes. Did I go to a Catholic school, elementary Catholic school? Yes. Of course, I saw many instances in my neighborhood in Philadelphia where people did what it take to get a high. And a good deal of my work, early work, wanted to try to dignify those lives that we only see in Hollywood movies that give a portrayal of the underclass such that it reaffirms policies that may disadvantage whole groups of people or have us write them off because of our particular religious or moral compass. And it was very important for me. I wrote that poem back in the late 80s, early 90s. And my intention back then was to give a portrait that was different from the evening news and popular culture.
I just want to read the last stanza because I think it's really beautiful. Out of the house, in the poem, you've described your mom going into, I guess, a place to go smoke crack. And then at the end, you write, "Out of the house, my mother steps, returned from the ride of her life, studies pavement cracks for half-empty vials, then looks back at bricked-over windows as though what else mattered? A family, a dinner, a car, nothing but this happiness so hard to come by." This happiness so hard to come by. I think that's a line that anyone can relate to, whether you're addicted to drugs or not. Mm-hmm. It's hard to come by in this life sometimes.
There is, even when one doesn't suffer from those kinds of social ills, you know, there sometimes there's an emptiness in us, and we find all kinds of ways to fill that void. For my mother, I can even pinpoint around the time her behavior started to change. She was definitely someone who was responsible, did very good in school, very much respected at work. And then she lost pretty much her adopted mother. And there was no one there to kind of fill that void. And she turned to drugs. And there are all kinds of life situations that sent us in the directions that are harmful, in which we don't make maybe the best decisions. But they're decisions made out of desperation. It's interesting, that last line, I stumbled into it. Like I didn't aim to write that line. That line literally was the last line. This happiness so hard to come by. So it's interesting how when you write, if you are a writer, writing is not just writing what we know, but exploring what we don't know and hopefully coming up and digging deep in our subconscious to find some of the answers that we need to live, to make it to the next day.
Mm. But writing poetry is different in the sense that, as you just illustrated, it's meant to be read aloud. Mm. It's meant to be heard. And when you hear it, maybe it sounds different than when you read it or write it. So this collection is new and old poems, as we've discussed, older poems over the course of 20 years. Still relevant, just older. But I noticed the newer ones, you write a lot about the climate.
Ooh, you are astute reader. Thank you.
Well, I mean, all you do is read the poetry. I'm a reader. I don't know how astute I am. Anyway, so is that your preoccupation now?
I've been living in Vermont since 2002. My other home is in Nashville, Tennessee. And it's hard to ignore some of the changes that are happening right around me. We have shorter winters. What that means is that it's going to impact the economy here, which is built around winter sports and tourism. I'm also noticing that it's impacting how the trees kind of arrive. And I'm particularly talking about our autumns, which are kind of world famous here in Vermont. But yeah, the climate is hard to ignore the headlines. And I'm not an alarmist, but I am a realist. And it's important to me that I help raise some consciousness around what I feel is kind of related to how we treat each other, which is how we treat the land is how we treat ourselves and treat whole groups of people. And recognizing the dignity of each other means we recognize the dignity of the spaces around us.
Can you read a little bit from the poem called Climate? It doesn't take an astute reader to see that you're concerned just by reading the title. But I'm wondering if you could read a little bit from this poem.
Sure. Climate, what the heart knows. A ramekin of warm peach cobbler crowned with a splodge of vanilla, whose slow melting is the altering of the seasons, the coming of autumn swirling in the mass of milky orange sugar. Bach's Sonata No. 1 in B minor, its opening movement, a sojourn reminiscent of December rain, or my grandfather, graveside, alone, his frightened stare into a dirt hole recalling his errors. The heart knows the spine as the exquisite corridor to the senses, noodle-like strands registering the tingling of beach pebbles underfoot. A courageous plunge into an iron-cold sea, or the way you feel when she pulls her favorite lichen-green dress over her head, rivering her body. A fabric waterfall across the heart, which also knows Orpheus's frantic reach, Bernini sculpture, Pluto's ghost white fingers clutching Proserpina's thigh in the Borghese, or Serena's shattering swing, her victorious scream. Yet the heart does not know primordial dangers, wildfire scattering a devil's dream, hurricane winds drowning castles to make a sudden skeleton of us all, and why we devour and swallow earth like vultures on a highway and stand round waiting our turn. Maybe I am an alarmist. I don't know.
Yeah.
That poem was really fun to write because it was so much about capturing senses, whether they were taste. I was thinking about how much I love pie with vanilla ice cream on it. Thinking about sound, thinking about Bach sonata, thinking about the rain when my grandmother died and my grandfather standing by the grave with this pensive look. Thinking about walking on a beach, thinking about great art I've seen in the world, and then suddenly, like, I'm turning. Yet the heart does not know its dangers, you know? Yeah. And I guess there is a connection, which is, you know, our senses are how we understand the world around us. And what does that mean in an age in which we are quite possibly going to lose shorelines? I'm thinking of Florida, thinking about my great love for California, and then knowing in some parts that if I go to those forests, they're burnt.
What it also says to me is, look at our duality, look at all the beautiful transcendent things humans can create and do, and look at all the destruction we can also wreak.
I hear your inner poet.
You're bringing it out in me. But like, we can make a perfect peach cobbler or a Bernini sculpture or a sonata that is transcendent, and we can also ruin the earth.
Yeah. For me, it's just a question of care. We love great art. We care about great art. We love good food. We care about good food. Maybe we don't have the connection to the earth like we should, and as a result, we don't care as much.
I'm going to quote something that you wrote: that poetry advances an untainted vision of humanity that preserves our dignity as a species and works to maintain the sovereignty of language against abusive and corruptive rhetoric that breeds hatred. So are you saying that poetry has a place in our political discourse, in our in mainstream culture? Because I think a lot of people see poetry as something removed from that it's something that's beautiful and nice, but not something essential to daily life.
The relevance and purpose of poetry in our lives is constantly debated. I think we never question the purpose of poetry when something tragic enters our lives or happens, whether it's the passing of a friend or a beloved or a parent, we turn to poetry. When someone is getting married, guess what? There's going to be a poem as part of the program. The political discourse is, I guess what I was talking about there is that poetry attunes us to language, authentic, artful language, and language that emerges during election season is meant to persuade us. And as a result, it can be a little manipulative. And what I want to argue is that if one lives a life inside language, either as a reader or as a writer, you're even more attuned to kind of hear how rhetorically language is used against people. The other way that poetry is relevant in terms of a democracy is that each voice counts. And if you are a reader or a writer of poetry, you treasure the unique experience, worldview, opinions of a single person writing from their inner self. The performance of poetry, we feel it as a collective, as a group. But when you sit down with your screen or on a book, it's almost like a voice is coming off the page to say something that either you hadn't thought before, or you felt before but didn't have the language. It's a magical transaction that happens. And that little voice within a large democracy such as ours becomes something that we treasure.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I treasure this moment. Thank you so much for the opportunity to chat with you.
Oh my gosh, it's my honor. That's Major Jackson. His new book is called Razzle Dazzle, New and Selected Poems from 2002 to 2022. And you can check out his podcast. It's called The Slowdown, and you can get that wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, Evan Kleinman is here to talk about the best farmers markets. Some of them will deliver to your doorstep. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentils?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bam right there.
Pie.
You know what that means. Evan Kleinman is here to ring in the new year with some ideas for healthy eating. She hosts, of course, KCRW's Good Food. Hello, welcome, and happy new year.
Same to you, Madeline.
Thank you. All right. So you talk a lot about supporting farmers markets on your show. You have a weekly segment where you visit one. It's called the Market Report. And on the face of it, I think people say, oh, it feels like a luxury to go to farmers markets. But you disagree. So tell us why.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about what we should do for the first show that we have together. At the beginning of the year, when everybody's thinking about dieting and trying to get healthy and about their new exercise regime. Mm-hmm. And I just thought to myself, you know, farmers markets can really solve a lot of the things that we're concerned about. You get better quality produce that often has higher nutritional value and greater flavor, precisely because many farmers concentrate on building soil. The greater the microbial diversity of the soil, the more nutrition the vegetables and fruit grown in it will have. So flavor is related to the actual health and nutrition of the plant. And also many varieties of vegetables that farmers market farmers choose to plant taste better because they're bred for flavor rather than visual consistency or longevity.
But can they be more expensive than going to the supermarket?
These days, man, I don't think so. And I really have to say that when you shop at the farmer's market and you buy from a farmer where the produce that's on offer is really vibrant and beautiful looking, that produce, in my experience, lasts much longer. The last time I did a good shop at the Hollywood Market, 2 weeks later, I was still using the lettuce from that shop.
Huh. Wow. That does say something because I know when I buy the bag lettuce, in 3 days, some of it has gone slimy and I toss the whole thing out if I haven't finished it.
I mean, it's a different show, but I could go on a whole rant of why you shouldn't buy bag lettuce. But no, let's just concentrate on the positive.
I do it for convenience, so I'll eat it more than having to wash it and dry it.
I hear you. And I know that, you know, shopping the market can feel like adding another chore to the list. But I'm going to argue that even if it's just once a month, we should seek out the experience.
Because it's an experience. There are people there that you might want to see in person.
Absolutely. I mean, I tend to be a real, intense hermit. And at a time when for many people it's easy to isolate or feel isolated, walking through a farmer's market always makes me feel so much more connected to here, to LA where I live. And you meet those who grow your food, which is always fun. You form meaningful connections, maybe with somebody you ram into with your cart. So even if you only manage to show up in person once a month, it's worth it for your overall mental and physical health. And I would bet that there is a market not far from every listener, unless they're out of state. Here in LA, there are over 150 certified farmers markets in LA County each week.
Okay, what are your favorite farmers markets?
Well, the one I managed to go to. Because truly, I'm such a sloth. But for me, most often, it's the Hollywood Farmers Market because it's near where I live. It's on Sunday. It's more chill with people showing up in the LA version of outdoor PJs, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And aside from the great farmers with their produce on offer, you can have breakfast or lunch there and get dinner to go from one of the food vendors, which I always love when I can do more than one thing at a time. I tend to make a beeline for Delmi's pupusas. But I have to say, you know, if my weekday schedule allows, nothing makes me love life more than the Santa Monica Market. It's just the best of the best in terms of farmer selection because of how closely it's policed by the managers. Many farmers come from farther away, which means you're experiencing food grown in a wider variety of microclimates. And there's a view of the Pacific Ocean.
Okay, if you are feeling a little, I don't want to say slothful, but you did bring up that word, slothful, and you don't want to go out to a farmer's market, but you still want that produce, there is a way to have it delivered.
100%. I mean, there are many fewer produce boxes on offer in LA County since the, quote, end of the pandemic, but there still are quite a few. So we've talked about a lot of other things. We don't have a ton of time, but I really want people to go to the website, to the document I've created, which has many recommendations for places where you can still get produce boxes either picked up or delivered. Let's highlight two, Madeline.
Okay, go for it.
Well, the reason I started thinking about doing this was because I got this email from the nonprofit organization that runs the Hollywood Market, as well as several other markets in town. They're called CLA. They're a nonprofit. They have a wider mission than just running the farmers market. And they have started an online portal called Eat with a exclamation mark. You can order produce from a selection of farms and you can either pick up your order at the farmer's market or get it delivered. I mean, that's amazing. A box of farmer's market produce delivered to your house. I've done it. It's awesome. It's a win for the farmers and for we lazy bones. But what I love about this initiative that CLA has been able to do is through their community partnerships, they use this online portal to distribute over $25,000 in produce to low-income EBT-eligible families in South LA, which also put $25,000 in the pockets of small farmers. I mean, talk about a win. The other place I wanted to talk about, aside from CLA, is offering that I know you have used, and that is LA Home Farm.
Oh, yeah, in Glassell Park. It is fantastic, run by a woman named Lori Kranz, and it's got great curated boxes, really affordable, and then also lots of yummy ready-made food.
Yeah, so you can do the whole add-on thing. And that as well, you can either go to their brick and mortar or you can get it delivered.
Exactly.
I have a total of 6 or 7, I think, places, some of which are for fruit. There is nothing like eating fruit in season that's grown locally.
Okay, and those are all on the website.
Yep.
Okay. With links at kcrw.com. Evan Kleiman hosts KCRW's Good Food. You can hear it Saturday mornings at 10. You can subscribe to the podcast and to Evan's newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. And Evan, what is on your show this week?
So we are re-airing the show in which we took the entire hour to explore the extraordinary man that is Lalo Garcia, who is a chef who ended up getting deported to Mexico and created lemonade out of lemons, has created an extraordinary life. And it's just such an unbelievably great story that we gave it the whole hour.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, well, listen for that at 10 o'clock again on Saturday or wherever you get your podcasts. Evan Kleiman is the host of KCRW's Good Food. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
And that does it for us today on Press Play. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you again tomorrow.